Thanks for joining Wintrust Business Lunch. G here, short for G Suk Yee. Great Friday show for you today, including how to accelerate your career and get to that big corner office even sooner. But let's start with Mark Hamrick. He is the Bankrate.com Senior Economic Analyst. And we just heard Orion in his report talk about the jobs report, but we're going to go a little bit more in depth with Mark. Hi, Mark.
Hey, how's it going? Thanks for having me. Happy Friday.
Same to you. Fantastic to have you talk with us. So let's go into this jobs report. Really good numbers.
Yeah, I think it was generally better than expected. And, you know, these days, I think anytime we get quote-unquote good news, we'll take it. So, you know, that headline number, of course, 225,000 jobs added on the month, that was well above expectations. Remember, in December, the number was only 145,000. Now, mind you, this is in a workforce of 150 million, you know, so if we get something that's, you know, sort of 50,000 plus, we need to keep that in context. We had more people working and looking for work, so so-called labor force participation rose by 0.2%, so that's, again, a pleasant surprise on that front. And that can have the impact, and indeed it did this time, of sending the unemployment rate up a little bit to 3.6%. And finally, as people say, show me the money. Well, we saw a little better there on the wage front, with average hourly earnings up 3.1%. It's not back to the peak that we saw, but we were up from 2.9% in the month of December. So all in all, pretty good looking report.
Mark, if we're going to break down the numbers by industry, which industries are doing really well?
Well, first of all, we think that there may have been some impacts that would not necessarily be sustainable because of warmer than expected January weather. And the chief suspects there are construction, where we saw 44,000 jobs added, and leisure and hospitality up some 36,000. And the major contributor there was bars and restaurants. And those do tend to be quite weather, let's say, sensitive. Healthcare, you know, that's a steady performer just about all the time. In part because of the fact that we just have an aging population, and we know that people get more medical care generally now than they used to. 36,000 jobs added there. Retail saw the decline of 8,000 jobs on the month. We know the store closings trend is very much remaining intact. In the past week, we had Macy's announce that it would be closing more stores, limiting 2,000 jobs at the corporate level. And manufacturing remains sort of ground zero for weakness across the global economy, with a decline there of 12,000 jobs on the month. I'm sure that you paid attention earlier in the week to the report from the Institute for Supply Management, which showed for the first time since July in its report that manufacturing was growing. But here in the month of January, with this reading at least, we saw manufacturing continuing to pull back. And of course, trade tensions have been one of the chief irritants there.
As an economist, how concerned are you about the retail apocalypse, and are they going to be able to bounce back?
First of all, I do think that that phrase is probably you know, good for conversation, but not necessarily indicative of what is truly happening.
Very noted, Mark. I will stop using it.
Well, no, I mean, you know, hey, to each their own, because retailing continues to be a significant contributor to the economy and a significant employer, and as we know, the composition of our consumer purchases has changed dramatically, because these days you take out the phone, you know, you want the kale potato chips, the kale chips delivered immediately, and you can have them on your doorstep, you know, the next day, and you don't even have to go out of the house or apartment. So, you know, the migration of sales to the likes of Amazon, but also the likes of Walmart and Target, among others, on the online realm, doing better. But there's tremendous, and I know it's to some degree an overused phraseology, but it is tremendous disruption that's associated with innovation in the retail space. And, you know, if you sort of divide malls into four groups, and you think of like the top performers being in the top half and the worst performers being in the lower half, it's that lower segment that Macy's is pulling out of. But, you know, I have the good fortune of living and working here in the Washington, D.C. area, and so thank you, taxpayers, for, you know, contributing to a strong economy here. I go to a mall near my house that, you know, is a very robust environment in there, and there's still a significant number of spaces in that mall that continue to rise. days. You know, Sears having left there, near and dear, of course, to your hearts there in the Chicago area. And Macy's is probably going to, my guess is Macy's probably going to have to eventually probably get out of maybe, you know, 60% of the square footage that it has in that mall, because it has a home store too. But at the same time, what you see occupying these spaces, at the least in the more healthy economies, is the likes of Tesla, which, I mean, there's only one Tesla, so Tesla, there's no other likes of. You see some of the online-only brands coming into those spaces where they want to have a touch point for consumers. Let's say, well, they want to see what the clothing actually looks like before they put in the online order. And then services, you know, you can have dental services in those locations. You have some co-work spaces taking up those some of that square footage, VR experiences for entertainment, and then, of course, the entire entertainment realm, whether it's films, bowling, restaurants, bars, and the like. So it's just a very dynamic area. Consumers haven't stopped spending. It's just how they spend is different.
Mark, I know you still have an eye on the coronavirus and its effects on the global markets, but what are you going to be looking for next week?
Well, probably, first of all, we have Federal Reserve Chairman Jerome Powell going to Capitol Hill beginning on Tuesday for his semiannual testimony. This doesn't seem to be a situation where he's going to sort of knock the ball out of the park, so to speak, with respect to telling us anything we largely didn't already know. Just today, the Fed released a report on monetary policy, which is sort of just a full disclosure thing, where it did acknowledge that the coronavirus is a new risk that's emerged for the global economy, and how and whether it sort of spreads beyond China and Asia, and I'm really talking about economic impacts beyond the health impacts. I'm quite certain that the Fed is now wondering whether this could be another reason that it may have to eventually cut interest rates again. And then on Friday we'll have retail sales, and obviously that's not only consistent with what we were just discussing, but we want to know the consumer, obviously very confident these days with all the consumer confidence readings we get between the Conference Board and the University of Michigan, but how much is the consumer actually spending now that they continue to have a strong job market and some real wage gains?
Well, it sounds like we're going to have to talk to you very soon. Mark Hamrick, he is the Bankrate.com Senior Economic Analyst. Thanks so much for talking with us. We have a lot more coming up. G here with the Wintrust Business Lunch, joined now by travel expert Peter Greenberg. We just heard him a little while ago talking with John Williams, but we're going to be talking a little bit more about the business side of travel. Hi, Peter.
Hello, G.
So great to have you in studio. So you're here in town for the Chicago Travel and Adventure Show, and of course you have your fantastic show, Eye on Travel, right here on WGN Radio from 4 to 6 p.m. on Saturdays.
Yes, ma'am.
Sometimes the time moves a little bit depending on what we have airing, but
it's sports sometimes, yeah.
Yeah, but we can always look forward to hearing from you on Saturdays.
You got it.
So let's talk about cruise lines especially.
Well, here's the thing. Most people don't realize that a very small percentage of Americans have even taken a cruise. This is an industry that's still in its infancy. And yet, every major shipbuilding company in the world is operating right now at 100% capacity. They're building ships of every pedigree and size because they looked at the numbers and they realized the upside here is phenomenal. If you go back to the days of the Love Boat, right, 1978, there maybe were 80 ports that cruise ships called on. You know, that was it. And most of them were like Nassau in the Caribbean. You know what it is today? Over 1,400. So you're thinking, you want to go to the Russian Far East? You can sail there. Want to go to Bangladesh? You can sail there. The entire South American coast, the Western African coast, the Antarctic, the Galapagos, it's everything. So now the opportunities are there, and they're building purpose-built ships for those regions.
So the reports are that Carnival Cruise Line, Royal Caribbean, and Norwegian Cruise Lines are banning people who have been to China in the weeks before a cruise from sailing on their ships.
Not surprising. Listen, right now we're in a sort of hysterical moment where if one person coughs on a cruise ship, they quarantine 6,000 passengers. So the economic impact on the cruise lines is significant. The inconvenience impact on passengers is large. So what you're seeing the cruise lines do, other than just the ban, they're reorienting their entire itineraries. They're bypassing most of the ports in Asia. So they're not stopping in Hong Kong. They're not stopping in coastal China. They're moving further south. And that's prudent. I mean, you expect that to happen. And by the way, for people who want to take a cruise, whether it's Asia or the Caribbean or anywhere, the cruise line reserves the right in force majeure situations like this to basically redo the itinerary without saying that they're in default.
So you're not recommending that folks not take a cruise?
Not at all. I would go to China in a heartbeat. How about that? Listen.
But you're a travel expert.
well, no, but I'm trying to make everybody else a travel expert. The bottom line is basic common sense and good personal hygiene. You wash your hands before and after you eat. You wash your hands before and after you go to the bathroom. If you're flying on a plane, use some antiseptic wipes. Wipe down anything that's going to touch your skin. The tray table, the armrest, the headbacks, and the nozzles above your head for the air vault. That's a good way to go. That's not going to stop me from going somewhere, though.
What are the effects right now because of the coronavirus and the travel bans and the grounding of flights on the travel industry?
Well, that is a very significant story, because if you look at it a little more clearly, you'll see it benefits us. I mean, I'm not saying that we should poo-poo the severity of the virus. But by the way, there is a silver lining here. The Chinese outbound market is the largest in the world. That has effectively collapsed. So the reason why the airlines canceled flights up until May to all those cities in China isn't because they were over an abundance of concern about the virus. They had nobody on the planes. It was zero. It was beyond flatlining. And so they just pulled out, right? Cathay Pacific, the Hong Kong-based airline, just told their staff they were taking a three-week unpaid leave yesterday. So the economic initial short-term impacts, significant. However, let's get beyond just China. It's not about where the Chinese were flying to the U.S. or whether we were flying to China. The North American market doesn't really matter here. It's where the Chinese were going outside of China and where they stopped going. So as a result, it's a worldwide buyer's market for travel right now. Do you know what the round-trip ticket is between Boston and London right now?
I did listen earlier on John Williams' show, but
I'll tell you, it's $255. It's more expensive to fly on the Boston to New York shuttle than to go to London. You will find that in many other markets in Europe and in Asia right now. So there's a buyer's market. You're seeing hotel occupancies drop because the Chinese aren't traveling. You're seeing retail taking a hit. You're seeing restaurants. Anything associated with the travel experience is getting hit, which means law of supply and demand, we win.
So how long do you foresee these great deals? I have to talk to my boss about taking an extended weekend.
Well, you've got some time to think about it, because remember, the airlines have canceled their flights through May. That's 3 months from now. More than likely, even if they resume their flights in May, they're not going to be filling those flights on June 1st. It's another three-month lag time from there. So the seasonality of travel deals is basically out the window right now, and you're going to see airfare sales, hotel sales through probably August.
Speaking with travel expert Peter Greenberg, of course, this is the Winterest Business Lunch. Is there a difference between booking for business travel versus for pleasure?
Absolutely not, because most business travelers who are smart business travelers either extend their trip or figure out a way to bookend something. It gets down to the conversation you have when you book the ticket, whether it's an airline ticket, a hotel room, a cruise ship berth. You have to have a conversation that goes beyond the rate. You know, we're all motivated by rate. In fact, if an airline advertises a fare and it moves $5, the needle moves along with it. You can move the market on $5. That's how stupid we are, okay? Because it's not about the rate, it's about the value. So you see a hotel room for $149 online, you go, great, I'm booking it. But you haven't asked the right questions. Hey, can my kids stay free? Can they eat free? Will you throw in free parking? Will you get rid of that draconian resort fee? Will you throw in free Wi-Fi and not charge me $6 for a small bottle of water? All of those are negotiable items that the internet cannot do for you. You need to have a conversation. Otherwise, you just double the cost of your room thinking you got a great deal because you found it online.
Is it always better to bundle the air flight with the hotel stay?
Absolutely not. No, absolutely not. Because you only want to bundle what you actually need. So, for example, the tour operators in Hawaii always would bundle things. They'd sell you a very low airfare, which also included, you know, 5 or 6 nights at a hotel and a rental car. If you actually divided that pie, it took out each piece of the pie, you realized even if you didn't need the rental car or the hotel room, the airfare was worth it. You didn't even have to stay at the hotel. Those days are sort of over now. They figured that scam out, right? But if you can bundle it to your advantage, do it. But you've got to be able to pull out the pieces of the pie. And if they don't let you do that to figure out what you're actually paying for each component part, then don't do it.
Is it worth it to pay for a travel agent?
My guess is yes, and I'll tell you why. When you look at your computer screen, if you go to book online, you're only seeing 52% of the available inventory because every travel provider holds back, whether it's a hotel, a cruise line, or airline. So you're disenfranchising yourself from 48% of the inventory just because you decided to go the easy way out and book online. Having a conversation with a travel agent, who, by the way, these days, travel agents specialize, right? There's a travel agent that specializes in nothing but barge cruises. And there's another travel agent that specializes in nothing but bicycle trips. I'm sure there's a travel agent that specializes in one-armed fugitive travel. And they're paging Richard Kimball as we're speaking. But the thing is, why wouldn't I have 8 different travel agents? Guess what? I do. You go for the area specialization because they have preferred supplier relationships that you don't have. They can get you a room when the hotel says they're sold out. They can get you a cruise berth when the cruise ship says they're full. It's amazing what they can do.
Is there an average cost that you should be paying?
Well, if a travel agent wants to charge me a service fee for getting me something I couldn't get or getting me a better deal that I couldn't get on my own, I'll write the check.
You've been so many places all over the world. Is there a spot that still remains on your bucket list?
Well, I'm opposed philosophically to bucket lists. You know why?
Why?
Because everybody has the same thing on their bucket list. Where do you want to go? Paris. Right. I want to go to Paris.
And
by the way, they always say it like this. I want to go to Paris. You know what? You know why they want to go to Paris?
Why?
They're all failed art history majors. They studied the painting in school. They figure they better go at least once. They'll stand in line at 11 hours at the Louvre. And they'll come back an hour later going, it's so small. It is. And everybody listening who's seen the Mona Lisa knows exactly what I'm talking about. Take your bucket list and burn it. You should have a list. The only list you should have is every place you've never been. Every place you've never been. That's a bucket list.
Okay, coming up, we're going to tell you how to accelerate your career and get to that corner office a lot faster. Thanks so much to Peter Greenberg. Don't forget, you can listen to him 4 to 6 p.m. right here on WGN Radio on Saturdays on a show, Eye on Travel. And he's also going to be at the Chicago Travel and Adventure Show this weekend.
On Sunday, I'll be out there.
Fantastic. Thanks so much. A lot more coming up on WGN Radio. G here. Thanks for staying with Wintrust Business Lunch. Hey, are you in your 30s, late 30s, 40s? Early 50s, you're feeling a little bit stuck. You're a mid-career professional. You feel you're in a rut. You want to change things up, and LinkedIn just isn't doing it for you. Well, I have founders, two friends, Chris Peterson and Dave Chanowski, in studio with me. Hi, Dave. Hi, Chris.
Hi. Thanks for having us.
You guys designed a new networking system called Future Execs.
Yep.
What's the point?
Well, the point is that we found that when you're in your mid-career stage, like you just like you said, you sort of feel like you're in like career purgatory, right? Like you've been working at it for 10, 12 years or something, and you're just like eye the C-suite, and you're like, how do I get there? And between like working all the time and having like a demanding family life, you're like, I don't have time to network anymore. So you might have a million people on LinkedIn that you know, but like your industry contacts aren't necessarily as good as they should be.
Well, my issue with LinkedIn, although it's great resources and I have a lot of friends that have used it very successfully, is that you end up connecting with people that you don't know at all. So then I can't tell who's a real connect and who's, I feel bad not saying yes to somebody that just wants to connect with me.
Right. And you shouldn't have to.
Well, I think with connections, it has to be done the right way. And with more and more tech, you know, it's kind of like every time we add another piece of tech, it's just another flavor of the day, right? But when it comes to careers and things that are very personal to us, you need those human moments. You need those face-to-face interactions to really have a deep, meaningful conversation and you know, have that conversation that could potentially lead to something better in your career.
Chris, Dave, you're both young guys. You are of the tech generation. So it's very interesting that you're saying, you're talking about old-fashioned values of looking somebody in the eye and meeting them face-to-face.
Yeah, yes, and with a handshake.
Yeah, and like it's crazy because, and we completely acknowledge this, and we're not like anti-tech guys by any stretch of the imagination. We just sort of, you know, and when everything's going in this technological bend and we're starting an organization that's sort of running in the opposite direction, we think that's what kind of makes it interesting. And in fact, you know, when one of the things that we did as we were researching this idea is we went out and talked to, I think, 50 different recruiters and professionals around the country. And the thing that was so fascinating is they sort of all acknowledge, like, I have too much tech. I'm in tech overload in my day-to-day job. And I use it to contact people, but they're even seeing diminishing returns on that. So we're finding a lot of companies are actually trying to get more personalized in their approach to building out their networks. And so we think that we're just at the tip of the spear of kind of this, not a reversion to that, but to, you know, try to find ways to connect more at a human level.
Are you finding, Dave, that most jobs are given to folks that have a referral from inside of the company? Somebody knows them, they can stand behind their work and vouch for them.
That's absolutely the way it still works. So the big irony is that this tech ecosystem is really, we've designed this framework around how people historically don't get jobs. You know, you get jobs by knowing someone, having made a connection, you can vouch for someone, having had a conversation and taking it from there. And, you know, to see the world continue to go one direction, Chris and I are saying, no, I think we need to go old school and go the other.
Well, I want to get down to the nitty gritty of exactly what future execs can do. But first, I want to thank you both for your service, because you're former U.S. Army officers, and you've done this. You've been in this line of work for a while. You actually sold another staffing recruiting.
Yeah, we had a coming out of business school, which is where Dave and I met. We actually started what started. It was a simple recruiting conference business for military veterans at the top graduate schools, and we eventually evolved it into this sort of much larger thing that we never dreamed of, where it was, became a bit of a tech company. We developed some software, and yeah, it was acquired 2 years ago. But we also worked in corporate environments. So it was, now we're kind of taking that lens, this through the lens of like, that was way in the past, and now, you know, I want to go be the CEO of something, or I want to jump from a big company into a startup or PE or something like that. And how do we even begin to do that? And that's kind of what Future Execs is about.
Okay, so you sign up for Future Execs. What happens?
So what we do is we run a series that we model them after startup accelerators. So startup accelerators are great because they give people mentorship and networking and all that kind of stuff. We've taken that model and we've instead applied it to really specific groups of functional experts. So we're, for example, running an event in April here in Chicago for people who have been specifically trained in brand marketing. And then we're going to connect them with organizations and companies that want to actually mentor them, network with them, and then maybe even recruit them down the road.
So there's an online element, but there's also a person-to-person element.
Yes.
And what happens at this event?
So, you know, what happens is we'll curate this network of group of people, and they'll come in, and we actually are bringing in, there'll be a series of panels of people. You know, your boss isn't going to tell you what's best for your career, because they have a vested interest in you continuing to work for them if you're doing a great job. So here you get to network with people outside of your company, but still within your industry, and they'll coach you on how to best advance your career, how to kind of maybe pivot to a different industry. You'll get to meet 100 other people just like you who don't work at your company that are ability to, you know, network kind of laterally. And then we are even bringing in the former CEO of Clorox to come in, and he's going to talk about how his career developed, and then we just do a ton of networking.
Will there be recruiters there?
Yeah, there will. I mean, this isn't a career conference, because right. We look at it as an accelerator, right? You already have your career. You're just accelerating it from here on out. This is to give you the tools and the contacts
to get that promotion.
To get to that promotion or move to a different industry or just get more broad exposure. Because, look, at the end of the day, people don't have time anymore. And, you know, it's really hard to network, and no one's going to call you up to go have lunch with you. And so this is just a way to give people sort of like, it's like blending the efficiency and scale of LinkedIn with like the personalization of something like a one-on-one meetup or informational interview. So it's like a crash course in just networking.
It's like speed dating, except it's for your career.
Yeah, kind of.
Because you don't have time to go on all these individual dates, but you can just have it all happen in one space.
Yeah, it's like go there, take a Saturday, come down, meet a ton of people in your industry, make some connections, and maybe something happens in 2 weeks or 2 months or 2 years, but at least you've had that shared experience that you can just, you know, fall back on.
What's the feedback you've been getting so far?
It's been very positive. A lot of the recruiters that we've worked with in developing it, you know, they felt that actually true innovation in recruiting really hasn't happened in a long time.
So you're really learning the skills there, too, to set yourself apart from your other colleagues, to make sure that you catch the eye of your boss or the CEO, to make sure that you're considered for a promotion.
Yeah, and you get visibility. I mean, this is generally geared more towards you looking outside of your company.
Gotcha.
And to go outside of it. So like your boss isn't going to be there probably, you know, but this is a way for you to kind of just expand your horizons, like look at new companies, meet new people. And then, you know, maybe, you know, your next jump is a promotion. Maybe it's not inside your company. Maybe it's outside.
Where do we sign up and how much does it cost?
So cost is very nominal for the individual. It's actually, we will host these programs at high-end venues. So, you know, you expect maybe some mimosas, Bloody Mary, you know, like
that always helps.
It's a little more relaxed. It's on a Saturday, so you're not worried about dodging out of work. And, you know, for the cohort members or the professionals, I mean, just a few hundred dollars.
Yeah, I think it's $145. And then for companies, it ranges that want to be there and be a part of it and be part of this accelerator, it ranges from like $4,500 up to $10,000.
Sounds awesome. So it's industry specific, and it sounds like a bunch of great people that you can network with, and you don't have to go and find those connections yourself.
Yeah, and we're starting with this marketing one, but we're looking at expanding it to other functions and other cities. And
fantastic. And the website?
FutureExecs.com, one word.
Chris Peterson from St. Charles and Dave Chinowski from Peoria. So good Illinois boys.
That's right.
And Future Execs is spelled FutureExecs.
Yes.
Thank you so much, Chris and Dave.
Thank you.
A lot more coming up on WGN Radio. Happy Friday. G here with the Wintrust Business Lunch, joined now by Adrian Pellin. He is the Senior Vice President at Marsh. And you're asking yourself, what is Marsh? Well, it's so much more than an insurance broker and risk advisor. Adrian, tell us what Marsh is.
Hi, G. Thanks for having me today. Well, Marsh is a professional services firm, first and foremost, and it's part of the greater Marsh & McLennan Companies. We're based in New York, but have actually long roots and deep roots here in Chicago, where we were founded over 100 years ago.
Well, you are a senior vice president there. Tell us more about your role.
Yeah, so in my role, I lead a team of experts who specialize in infrastructure. We consult our clients on risk management and insurance issues across the infrastructure industry, including public entities, contractors, as well as investors.
Can you elaborate on what infrastructure means?
Well, infrastructure means a lot of things to many people. I think for my core focus, infrastructure is really around roads, bridges, highways, public transit, and airports, but it also includes social infrastructure. So that could be universities, hospitals, as well as water infrastructure.
So, Adrian, tell us, how are we doing? How is Illinois doing in terms of infrastructure?
Well, that's a great question, G. I would say, historically, we've not done so well, to say the least.
No.
I don't know if you've been through, at least in my neighborhood, I have to go to one underpass every day, and it looks a little stressed at times, but we've scored very poorly. We actually got a C- on the American Society of Civil Engineers report. So there's lots of room for improvement.
So this is a type of report card?
It is. It's absolutely a report card. Every 5 years, again, the American Society of Civil Engineers goes across and evaluates infrastructure of all types in every state, and each state gets a score. And we got C- in the 2018 report.
So C-, that is below average.
Absolutely.
So what do we need to be doing better? What do we need to prioritize?
It's a great question. Well, we need to invest more, and I think I'm very encouraged by what Governor Pritzker has done over the last year. We just enacted the Rebuild Illinois bill, $45 billion more in infrastructure investment, not only for Chicago, but for the state at large.
Well, it's fascinating what Marsh does for your clients. Your clients, the variety is pretty impressive. Can you describe who some of your clients are?
Yeah, well, it's, you know, I'm bound by secrecy to some in some respects, but we do a lot of work for a number of different municipalities, major cities across, in my focus, North America, but also with very large construction companies based here in Chicago, throughout the U.S. and Canada, as well as all over the world.
Well, I think it's fascinating. You help the government, you help investors, lenders, contractors, design and build contractors and consulting firms, too. So how do you help your clients?
Great question. So in our role, we really focused around risk, and there are a lot of risks around infrastructure development. So we work with our clients to understand what the risks are in investing, building, and maintaining infrastructure, catalog those risks, and then figure out how do they need to prioritize them. Thereafter, once we've worked with them, we help transfer those risks to a third party like an insurance company.
I really think it's cool. You have a Marsh 3D approach. So it sounds like you're looking at everything from every angle.
Absolutely. We try to. I mean, it's certainly around understanding the life cycle of our clients' needs.
What are some of the critical and emerging risks right now in infrastructure development? And I'm sure you know all of the tools to manage these risks.
Absolutely. Great question. I mean, there's four that we're really focused on right now. Political is a big one. And again, we have bipartisan support here in Illinois. We've got an infrastructure bill. We're going to see investment. So really excited by that. We have $8.5 billion allocated towards O'Hare. So that will be redeveloped. I don't know if you've gone through there recently. You know, we have had some leaky roofs, but very encouraged by that. And there's, I think, $23 billion allocated towards roads. Political risk, to me, is something we're overcoming, but exists virtually everywhere else in this country. Another big one is really around construction risk. So Illinois is actually one of the top three states in the country for being the most expensive and litigious to do business.
Oh, you don't say.
And
why am I not surprised?
Not surprisingly. So it was particularly when I work with foreign contractors coming in to build infrastructure in the U.S., in particular Illinois, they're completely shocked by how expensive things are, particularly around litigation, workers' compensation. So we try to work with them and help manage those costs.
Another area is digitization and emerging tech. This
yes.
is fascinating to me.
Yeah, so we're really excited by it. You know, our infrastructure, what we're investing in now, needs to be future-proofed. So the way that we really need to be thinking about things is, you know, we're funding taxes or paying for infrastructure through taxes right now, funded on gasoline taxes. But how does that change with energy efficiency and autonomous vehicles? How are we interacting with our infrastructure? So that's going to be a huge component. And data analytics is also a big one. Are we, you know, studying the appropriate information that we need to make appropriate decisions for infrastructure investments in the future?
Are you looking forward to self-driving cars?
I personally am very excited by it. You know, I don't know about you, but sitting on the Kennedy and driving is not my idea of a good time. So if I can read the paper and, you know, just sit back and relax, I think it would be great.
So no hesitation on your part.
No, not at all.
Another area that's interesting is epidemics, especially in light of the coronavirus.
Absolutely. Yeah, so that's been a very topical issue, as you can imagine. Coronavirus is all over the news. I mean, obviously, we've talked about it earlier today. Our clients in particular are now starting to evaluate, you know, what are the impacts related to coronavirus. So it in particular affects big cities like Chicago, public transit, the airport. And we're working very closely with companies to help them analyze and assess and understand what risks would be around an epidemic such as coronavirus and help them actually prepare and provide insurance for the financial loss as well.
It sounds very worthwhile, because not only are you defining these risks and opportunities, but you're also figuring out solutions.
Absolutely, which is critical. At the end of the day, it's not only understanding, using data and analytics, but also figuring out how can we transfer this risk to another party.
Adrian, what's the best part of your job?
You know, I'll be very candid. My wife always jokes with me about the insurance industry. And she's like, why do you do what you do? And I just tell my wife, Emily, I think insurance is sexy and cool. And I'm, you know, it's just a great industry. We get to work on cool things.
Well, you made it sound really sexy and cool. Thank you so much to Vice President at Marsh, Adrian Pellin. Thanks so much for being in studio with us today.
Thanks for having me, G.
The news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.